Welcome back to this week's episode of Rising Giants with your hosts Max Thornton and Dom Kalusic. On the episode, we have Gabrielle Faja, CEO of Sound School Music and producer of Madama Butterfly Opera. Gabby was born in Italy and grew up in a home with parents that were both classical musicians, where he grew a passion for music at an early age. He then attended the Royal College of Music in London, where he graduated in classical music performance and began his journey as a founder. His journey led him to Cambodia with his brother, and in 2011, he founded Sound School Music. Since then, Gabby has taken on different roles, including his most recent one as director of production for Madama Butterfly Opera. Key points from the show: discussing Gabby's passion for music and his journey moving from London to Cambodia, first mover founder, building Sound School in the early days of the music industry in Cambodia, and the challenges faced as a founder in the music and retail space, bringing the opera to Cambodia. What's in store for the production of Madama Butterfly? Be sure to purchase your tickets today for Madama Butterfly that's taking place on December 10th, 2023 at the Copeak Theater in Phnom Penh using the link that is tagged in the show notes. And also be sure to follow us at Rising Giants FM on TikTok and Instagram. We hope you enjoy the show.
Honestly, you have a fantastic podcasting voice. I don't know if that's the, it's perfect.
Just talented, I guess. I don't know. No one ever told me that.
Yeah.
But I'll take your word for it.
Fair enough. Yeah. Must be all the years of being classically
trained. All the cigarettes.
Yeah, and cigarettes. So just the combination of the two.
Yes, and age.
Great. Well, Gabby, thank you very much for coming on Rising Giants. It's great to have you on the podcast and to discuss your journey and, you know, some of the waves that you've been making in the creative and musical space in Cambodia. So first question would be is like, how did your career start in this industry? And maybe you can just talk a little bit about, how you kind of ended up in this sector.
Sure. First of all, thanks very much for having me on your podcast. It's a pleasure. And yes, I guess my beginnings are strictly musical. That's all I've known. My family is both musicians. Both my parents are musicians, classical musicians. My father was a conductor. My mother was a cellist. So since an early age, I had no chance of becoming a dentist or any such thing. I was sent to very, very young to music lessons. And fortunately, that was the beginning of the end of my prospects of any other thing. So, I mean, in a sense, the cool thing about being a musician and working in the arts, generally speaking, is that you do what you love for a living, which is great. That has to somehow marry with making a living as well. And in this segment, in this sector, music and the arts, that's not necessarily easy. But my upbringing was in Italy when I was born. And my father was Italian. My mother was English. And I would follow my father around theaters in Europe, especially in Italy. So I was kind of running around backstages and opera productions and symphonic orchestra concerts. I mean, meeting all the greats. I mean, I was really incredibly lucky in that respect. So that injected a passion and a drive for music from an early age, which I then developed. I then went to Royal College of Music in London. I did my master's in piano performance. And there, of course, in England, I continued to meet and play and collaborate with, some fantastic musicians and who are now recognized international stars. So, I mean, I guess I'm just thankful that this happened. And yes, and I developed an early passion for sort of starting a business pretty early on, which I did in London. So at the age of 21, 22, I was already starting little things, little music studios, online lessons. Even at the early online lessons in 2002, we already had a website. I mean, it's pretty insane. So yes, and that's my beginning, but it comes, strictly speaking, from a performance point of view. And not necessarily entertainment, but mostly from the stage as an art perspective.
Could you maybe just touch on a few of those musicians you mentioned that have now gone on to be like these international stars, just for the audience curiosity?
For sure. I mean, when I was at college, I remember, you know, when you're at college, you have to perform in front of your teachers in front of panels or judges, and Royal College of Music is an extremely high standard. And so even if you think you're good, there's always going to be somebody better than you. And I remember one day during our final recitals in year four, and we all had to play our 1 hour program by memory. I mean, it's so kind of pretty stressful. And you immediately knew from your peers, from your colleagues, who had the brilliance and no fear of the stage. And there was this violinist, Israeli violinist called Shlomi Dobrinsky. And he played his final recital on the violin. And I'd never heard anybody play like that. It would just, the hair would just stand at the back of your neck. Even though we were expecting it, it was just that good. And he went on to be a phenomenal recording artist and playing all the major orchestras in the UK, in Europe. And so I guess he's one of the best violinists I've met. Another such example is also William Simcock, award-winning jazz pianist, who I had the pleasure to organize a couple of concerts for. And he's a member of the Acoustic Triangle. And UK sort of megastar for jazz piano. These are just a few of the musicians I had the pleasure to kind of collaborate, speak and understand and learn from. So, very grateful this chance came to me.
Yeah, and you mentioned there about the first company you started, that was Beerbeck and Holmes, right? Okay. Could you talk a little bit about that agency and what it did, and I mean, if it's still around today, and what you saw as an opportunity there, and what it was like, you know, running your first business.
Well, we'll found that one. I almost forgot I had that early on. Yes, I was doing that at the same time as getting my postgraduate degree and eventually my master's. And Beerbeck and Holmes, it was the name. Beerbeck was the maiden name of my girlfriend at the time, and Holmes is the maiden name that I have, my family's on my mother's maiden name. So we thought we'd call it like that. It sounds like an estate agent. It sounded like one anyway. And it just organized concerts and represented classical musicians. I mean, this was, very grassroots at the time. We didn't know what we were doing. We were sort of 22, 23 years old. We made a lot of mistakes. But luckily we had the father of my partner, my girlfriend, believed in us, and he gave us the initial capital to, buy computers or, pay some for some halls and do some events. And that was great because, really sharpened our teeth at the reality of getting out there and trying things out. It's all very well speaking about it, but then you actually have to go and do it. I guess that grew over time as more and more musicians liked the idea of being promoted free. And as the audiences began growing, so did ticket revenue, and so did sponsors, and my access to facilities became easier. I could book larger venues also in the future dates, for example, which is quite hard to do in London. Anything from Wigmore Hall to Queen Elizabeth Hall, even the South Bank Centre, St. Joseph's Hall and St. James Piccadilly, all these sort of iconic venues which were now available to me. And so that grew pretty quickly, and we were, representing some great artists, including Meifu, including Shlomi Dobrinsky. And then it just kept on going. And then we went corporate, organizing things for, like, for example, annual parties for the banks, Deutsche Bank, NatWest, and so on. And moved into catering as well, organizing one nights in some of the museums, such as the Science Museum, Royal Albert Museum, taking over the venues for one night, became pretty big in the end. And that was my first successful business. Sold that for 12 million, I'm only joking. Then, unfortunately, we had a banking crash in late 2008 and beginning 2009, as you might remember. If you don't, remind you that was a pretty horrific occurrence. And we were working, as I mentioned, with a lot of the banks. And fortunately, that meant that was the end of the line for us in that respect. We didn't have the capital yet to be able to survive that. But that was an important lesson learned. And then I guess that's what prompted my move to Asia. You know, psychologically, you want to change after these things happen. So again, in late 2010, I made a decision to leave London and come to Asia. That was big by homes, but I'm very grateful that that happened to me because it taught me so many things, of course.
Yeah, no, it's like, I mean, with all the people that we've interviewed on the podcast, like, you know, if you're a first time founder and you haven't had any failure yet, sometimes that's normally not what you want to see. So of course it's great to have that early on and go through like starting a company and then having to see it finish because of something like that happened. But you said that you were then transitioning to Asia. How did then Cambodia happen? Was that always, I'm going to be going to Cambodia, or was it, how did you land here?
Good question. I mean, you know, there's this London halo effect that happens to musicians especially, but probably to many other professionals. When you're in such large cities, say Paris or New York or Tokyo or London, Berlin, you feel that you're already where you need to be, especially in your 20s, where you're sort of not really clued up at what's going on around the world. And so to move away from London is a strange decision because you work so hard to be there and to build your connections and to build your network, to then end up in some weird country where people don't even know where it is on a map. Makes kind of no sense. And you wouldn't advise your children to do that, your friends, you know, it's just really going against the grain here. But such are moments in life. And we knew that Asia, I'm talking about my brother and I, we knew that that Asia had something. And I specifically aimed for Vietnam. And for no other reason other than I knew where it was. And it kind of reminded me of Italy for the shape and so on. Had the sea. They told me I had good fish. So, you know, being Italian, I couldn't turn that down. And off I went on a little trip, a couple of months to check it out. And my brother came along. He was only 18 at the time, you know. We came back to London thinking, what are we doing here? Let's get back on the plane. And 3 months later, I sold whatever few possessions I had left from Yerbakan Homes and made my way to Asia. And for one reason or another, I ended up in Cambodia. Again, I think it just indistinguishable at the time between Cambodia and Vietnam. It really was kind of all one big blur of Southeast Asia. And I think somebody offered me some teaching position, some school in Cambodia and something like that. I ended up here by complete and pure chance. So it really was a non-conscious decision to aim for Cambodia specifically, which makes me fall in love even more with Cambodia now, because it seems almost like, you know, how you meet a girlfriend on Tinder. Sometimes it's a bit artificial, but Cambodia for me was like meeting a girl in a library or in a coffee shop or walking down the... That's the kind of metaphor that they use for that.
Great, great. Just curious, you mentioned your brother there and like, a few of the journeys that you've had. Have you always kind of been a unit and made these big life decisions together?
It's a very good point. We are very close. We maybe the way that our family was set up. My brother and I been very close both in life with our family, but also when we came to Cambodia, we lived together basically 7 years. And so a lot of my mistakes that I made, especially when when I mentioned Yerbakan Homes, he knew. And so when we came here early and we invested in the rise of the opportunities that Cambodia presented to us, we were a bit more careful with the little capital we had. And I guess, you know, having somebody to be able to talk to every day and make conscious and well-elaborated decisions based on just a lot of talking, a lot of thinking, a lot of mentoring, you know, this was a weapon. You know, my brother and I were weapons in 2011 in Cambodia. I mean, pretty unstoppable. So, I mean, I think, yes, it's only recently that we've sort of, we went separate ways because of, you know, work and life. But yes, I would say that we're definitely a unit, especially early on when we came.
You had mentioned about some of the endeavors that you had taken on and some of the business that you had started, and one of them specifically being Sound School. Can you tell us a little bit about the inception of that and how it really came about?
Clearly, and again, I think it's a nice story. I I arrived, and the first thing I did was teach English, like so many did at the time. I mean, remember that Phnom Penh, never mind Cambodia, I mean, Phnom Penh had so little to offer in terms of opportunities to make any meaningful income that we weren't really even sure that we were supposed to be here. But then I went to Meta House, which is headed by the great Nico, who is one of the patrons of the arts in Cambodia for so long, establishment. The time Meta House was organizing concerts, classical concerts, and I arrived and I'd asked, would it be okay if I did a concert here? And they looked at me and looked at my CV and said, sure, I mean, why not? This, you know, next month or the month after. And so I played my first recital as a pianist outside of, you know, so in Asia. It was my first time. And some people came and they saw me play and said, oh, wow, that's amazing. Do you want to be in my band? Do you want to do this? Do you want to teach my children? It was basically instant work. And I got into this silly band called the Phnom Penh Hippie Orchestra, which I cannot tell you. It's the funniest band ever. But this band played everywhere, from Battambang all the way down to Sihanoukville, on trains, on boats, on barges. On... So I got to meet every venue and every musician and playing this kind of klezmer gypsy music. And so my student network started growing phenomenally fast. I was 15, 20 hours a week in teaching. I was gigging every night. And then I formed my first jazz trio with Sebastian Adnaud and Thomas Willin, which was doing really well. And we playing almost every night, and in including stage performances, not just bars. And so we were really able to delve into creating some what I can say, pretty cool music. And at the time, that simply was not available in Cambodia. So we were getting a lot of good feedback from institutions. As my student numbers continued to grow, they were asking me if I can choose a piano for them. This is how sound school began. And so I would go to shops and try to find secondhand things for them and try them out and so on. And it became one, then two, and then three. And so I realized that this was not going to stop. So I asked a friend if they can lend me some money to buy some pianos from abroad, which I did. And I had a little 25 meter square shop somewhere where I put the 10 pianos, and they were sold out immediately. And for the first 3 years, from 2012 to 2015, I actually, not even joking, we sold 300 pianos. This is wood, the proper, you know, some grands. And it was just instant success. And nobody expected it. In fact, everybody said, you're mad for even attempting to have a piano shop here. But this, again, remember where we were. This is a country that has maybe had 10 pianos in, you know. So, and then we came and flooded the market, and everybody wanted them. And that, of course, then we needed to teach this piano. And so we started the first school. And so then we continued to reinvest money in, and Sound School was born. The piano shop was, of course, the initial breadwinner. And again, mistakes were made, because they always are. But you know, we continued to do pretty well, and Sound School kept growing, and student numbers, and staff, and locations, and here we are today.
What was the status of the music scene during 2012 to 2015? You had mentioned that there were only, you know, such a limited supply of pianos, grand pianos, mind you, but not only in pianos, but across other maybe classical instruments too. What was that scene like?
Well, if you speak as a retail scene, there were a few. I mean, there's always going to be shops that try the hardest to get something in, you know, because everything is important, you know. Sorry, imported in, and it's everybody's fending from themselves, really. So not much. The answer is not only not much, but we were such an early development of the arts in general, which is, as I was saying to Max earlier, today is a very different story. At the time, even as recent as 7 years ago, 7 8 years ago, like Cambodian family, which is what we're aiming at here, wouldn't even know why they would need a piano or why they would need to study the piano or practice it in the first place. Like, they couldn't wrap up, like, what is this thing? Is this some sort of infectious Western thing that we have to sort of, yeah. But, and it's only today that realizing the importance of a well-rounded education. So we came up with it early, I guess. So the scene was okay. There were a few NGO schools. Music Art School was one of them, which is still open today. And that was a great great start in 2014, I think. Symphony School of Art also was the first music school. So, you know, those institutions were crucial in a sense for the early development and the interest in classical music. And plus, I guess my trio was performing a lot. I was performing a lot. I think the consequence of all these things together was that it's kind of an early pioneering effort from a bunch of us at the time, which must have had some impact on what we see today.
And along with the success, you had mentioned that there were several mistakes along the way that you had encountered. What would be some of the ones that stood out to you the most that were the biggest learning experiences?
I think something that I take away from the early mistakes is just when you think you're right, when you think you got it, and that's it, you know, like, you know, you're convinced that this has to work, that's when you should worry about it. That you should worry that you are so convinced and you need to seek validation everywhere you look. And I failed to do that initially. I was so, you know, because I had some early success, so I think everything I touched was sort of turned into gold. And that was not true. And, you know, it's okay to have confidence, I think, if you're an investor, or if you're starting up a company, but you have to keep your feet on the ground. But the thing is that you can only learn that by sort of fucking it up, really. There's no other way. And somebody can tell you about it, but you're not going to believe it. You're going to continue to press ahead. And there's no difference between a business that fails and one that doesn't fail. I mean, they both have a leader that will continue to the end. Until is that a success or failure? So it's the two are so far apart on the circle that actually meet almost at the end. And there are many similarities with failure and success, at least in my opinion. So I guess the validation of your ideas, and I think obviously cash is number one thing. One thing I learned is not to look at profit necessarily when you start a business, but it's to look at cash flow. Of course, nobody's going to teach you that. And even if you do an MBA, I mean, you hear these words, but what does it mean? Like, cash is king, really, is the key. Having 30 grand in the bank or making a 30% profit at the end of the year, I'll take the 30 grand in the bank. Thanks very much.
Yeah, I know. It totally makes sense. Cash is king in that sense, too. And, you know, aside from teaching, with Sound School being a retail business as well, what are some of the biggest challenges that you faced in Cambodia being that type of business too? You know, there are a lot of stores in Cambodia, and it's always interesting to hear from the retail side what kind of challenges that owners face, maybe specifically to your industry as well too.
Yes, as foreign residents here, we have to understand that we'll never be able to compete at a local level with pricing, with even just a simple activity of marketing to their own kind, their own people. We always looked at it with a certain degree of skepticism, you know. There's also this allergy to foreigners coming and teach everybody how things are done, you know, which is also some of the remnants from the French olden days. You know, I think Cambodians had yearned to just do things themselves for once, you know, and I think that's great to see. So the challenge is kind of fitting in somewhere in there where you are both adding value but not being condescending or tutoring the customer or tutoring staff or tutoring even, it could be suppliers. So finding that balance, I think if you can be a foreign owned business but with a tinge of Cambodianness, I think you're halfway there. The challenges would have been imports were one of the greatest challenges. Now I think everybody that does imports in Cambodia knows what I'm talking about. It's you know, a lot of taxation rules were written sort of during the time that I was doing imports, so it was quite unclear. It is what it is here. You know, you have to get by. The biggest challenge is basically pricing and competition. I would say a large proportion of businesses early on, 2012 to 2016, probably were bypassing a lot of the local taxation, VAT, in some way or another. And you just can't compete with that, you know. And if you're of any size, I mean, say like if you're in any prominent location, you're going to get audited, you're going to get So you have to kind of comply. And so that's very difficult to explain to a customer why this guitar or why this piano is going to cost 10, 15% more. And they think, well, I don't care. I can buy it down the shop. And, so that was a challenge. And we overcame that challenge with branding. We decided we're going to be clean and we're going to represent our brands in a way that other shops perhaps didn't know how to do. And we had, one of the earliest e-commerce websites in Cambodia, already starting 2014. We're already selling online with payments, that is. And, so we kind of invested in that sort of setup, and eventually that started to grip, and we managed to overcome some of those challenges and represent the pricing that we had to stick to, say, look, at least you're going to get this kind of location, in this kind of design, with this kind of staff, with these kind of t-shirts, and with this kind of Fender, Roland, Yamaha gear, which is, original and imported. So we had to sort of long way around, but we got there in the end. So I guess branding and marketing was one of the ways to compete.
Yeah. And just one more quick note there too. It's, how you were able to prepare yourself kind of makes me think about the time when you started in 2002 with the online business there, and kind of having that preface or that knowledge of, as in this developing country, things are going to eventually start moving at an accelerated rate online.
Right.
That probably gave you a step ahead in a way comparatively to other businesses that may be selling the same product. So, going into the, 2018, 2019, like 2017 to 2020, basically up to COVID, that first wave of startup acceleration and growth, I'm sure that you were able to ride a little bit of that wave too.
Oh, I mean, looking back now, we all had a crystal ball. I mean, if you think about it, you're in the fastest developing region in the world with the most relaxed attitudes towards growth. I mean, this is there's no militia. There's no religious government here. It's basically pretty open, especially considering some of our neighbors, so you really only had to kind of just get stuff vaguely right and then you would get there. So I think that's you just got to stick it out. So you're right. You apply those principles, and like quality always works in the end, as long as you're consistent. You have to do a pretty bad job, So yes, I'm glad that I represent your viewpoint as well.
Great. Maybe just also just like, as Dom was saying, getting it up to, I guess, the present day. Maybe just one final question on Sound School. If we were to, fast forward a few years from now, where would you like to see Sound School at in its kind of, where it would be on like locations and students and that kind of thing?
Just before COVID began, we were about to sign a franchise deal in Vietnam to open our first Sound School in Ho Chi Minh. We had an investor ready. We had a location ready. We had all our paperwork done. Then they flew into each other's cities. That was very, very, very close to happening. Our first store there should have supposed to open in March 2020. I remember the date. If that happens, I have no doubt that we will see more than a dozen sound schools in Vietnam by now. I think the principle of applying brands for the use of somebody else to use probably is the way forward for sound school in the future. Wholly owned shops and schools is also possible, but the model that we see elsewhere, for example, in Vietnam and Thailand, is that we have the 20-30% ownership of the main sort of campuses, and then we give the chance of teachers to own their own school. That will be something that we'll be looking at. We would be doing that in a sort of financial responsible way, where they can sort of pay their way into owning the school and the brand. And that would make sense. That's one way we will see growth. Of course, Cambodia has a limited amount of people. There's only so many people that are going to learn piano and guitar, right? So we're going to keep it high end. We believe that's, by high end, that means the lesson quality and some of the pricing. So we believe that maybe another 3 or 4 locations in Phnom Penh and another couple of others around the country would be sufficient before we take it outside. That will be the natural progression that we believe might happen.
Okay, yeah, great. That's really, it's really interesting to hear that vision for the future. Maybe just also touching on well, shifting gears a bit over to, you know, this big, the big event that you'll be putting on, the opera, Madama Butterfly. Can you talk to us about how that all happened? And yeah, what's it been like putting on such a big production that will be taking place in December of this year?
Yeah, well, I'm glad you asked. I mean, I thought you would get a chance to plug it. Madame Butterfly. I mean, you know, you guys know about opera a little bit, or?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, by the way, I hope to see you there.
Yeah.
I mean, actually, you know, I'm not, this might come as a shock. I've seen maybe a dozen operas in my life. It's not my main occupation going to opera. And I don't listen to opera in the shower, at least not yet. But I feel opera is the ultimate classical event. And as I've already explained, my background was in event management. So Prince Ravi Sisawat, he's Undersecretary of State in Cambodia. He's a cousin of our king. He lives in Rome, and he is passionate about opera. Not just passionate, he lives and breathes it. He works in it. He's a fantastic ambassador for Cambodia in the arts and around the world. He rang me up and he said, we want to do an opera in Cambodia and we want you to be the organizer. And I said, well, that's fine. I'll do it. So let's get it together. So very quickly, we spun up a team. And I should mention that there's an executive producer called Ai Iwasaki, who is also my partner in Sound School, or rather was initially. And so we spun up this team and we began working with the auspice of the Royal Palace. The King wrote us a letter saying, good luck with it, I support you. And so did a couple of embassies, including the Italian embassy, which, big shout out, by the way, Italian embassy in Bangkok. I mean, there you go. You know, as soon as you put some pasta, pizza, Pavarotti there, they're sponsoring it straight away. I mean, it's immediate, which is quite cool to see. Yes, I mean, it's an immensely challenging project. I don't know how much you guys know about sort of how, I mean, have you been to an opera? I would imagine.
I have. I think I've been to one. I just cannot remember the name.
Okay. So you know how many moving parts there are on stage, and so there's a technical one on the theater itself. It has to be there with all the machinery and stuff like that, and sort of scenery and so on. Then there's the lighting. Then there's the audio. Then there's the artists themselves on the stage. There's the orchestra and the conductor in the pit, and there's a bunch of people that tie all this stuff together. This is on the performance night, never mind the rehearsals, of course. You have 100 people at any one time that have to sleep and eat and rehearse and move around. Then you've got a ticketing side, and obviously that's expecting 1,500, 2,000 people, online sales, invitations, government, royals, finding the logistics for all the entertainment, including alcohol sales and food. Marketing this to the audience, working with sponsors in a country where we have no theater, no orchestra, no infrastructure, pretty much. So if you ask me to do it again, I might say, oh, maybe. I might sort of just think about it a bit more. I mean, it really is a monster, this one. But I have to say, I'm pretty pleased with what's going on. And, you know, all this hard work in the end is going to pay off, I think. It's a beautiful opera. The music is stunning in every way. And we're lucky to have some great talents coming from abroad. And they've come here on very little money. I mean, and the reason that they come back is they recognize that this is a sort of like a watershed moment for Cambodia going forwards. If you can make the SEA Games happen in a country where, again, there was no stadium, and bang, they got a stadium going. Everybody came together, all the sponsors, ABA and so on. Selkab was in. And then an opera follows that, only months after the SEA Games. So Cambodia is now on the map, you know. This is a country that had no gravitas only 10 years ago, other than for its temples. And there's now there's local productions, sporting and music, taking, you know, is getting noticed. So we're very happy. I'm very happy that I had a chance to be in this and that I can help to shape some of these, as again, watershed moments. So I think the opera is going to be great for Cambodia. So yeah, I can't wait for it to be on.
Okay, and yeah, how big is it? So how many people do you expect to attend? Or how many tickets can you sell? Yeah.
Sure, well, we can sell 3,000 seats, although I think about About 800 will be for students, so we they reserve that for them. Of course, and we want the participation of the next generation to see, you know, I mean, basically this is what music is for. The arts are for sort of the next generation. And we expect, as I mentioned, about 1,500 to 2,000 paying tickets. We're about 800 at the moment, sort of about 7 weeks away. So yeah, it's a pretty big deal. I think the largest classical event before this was 2002 in Angkor Wat when Domingo came to sing. That was 21 years ago. I cannot find an event which had more than 1,000 people, classical event, since then. So pretty big deal. And both kind of scary in a sense because the pressure is on you to, you know, as I mentioned to you, Max, earlier, that, you know, you it's very easy to meet people here and to quickly make connections, but then people then associate you also with the mistakes that you make. And so, you know, it's you can disappear if you're in London, but here, you know, so yeah, there's a bit of pressure, but you know, happy to take it. So again, very happy for this to be happening.
So you said you've only got 200 tickets left to sell.
We're gonna get up around 1,500 to 2,000, so we've got 1,002 to go, but we're well on par for doing this. So I think we'll, our expectation is to be basically full.
Okay, that's great.
And just out of curiosity, what have you seen like the demographics of it so far? What's the, you know, what's the age that you're seeing that are going for this?
Yes, so far we most tickets are being bought by foreign residents. In the 30s, 40s, 50s, that's the demographic. Typically for opera, it tends to be slightly older than, say, Taylor Swift. I can't see why that would be the case, but it just happens to be. But the students that are going to be attending are going to be lowering that average pretty quickly. And those students are aged between 13 and 18, 19. That those are from various universities and various schools, including PAC, Pour Son Enfant, which is an NGO, an amazing NGO, but I should say French NGO, which does vocational training for students. They're coming. So, yes, I think that's the age. Now, for the Cambodian demographic, I mean, so Cambodians, nationals, typically you will see them booking quite late on. As they don't necessarily immediately understand what an opera is, not because of anything to do with them, it's just because this is so rare that they understand that, you know, what is this thing? Even the marketing is very hard to show them what a stage performance is. So I think as their friends start to book, it will sort of snowball later on. So we expect the end of November to be accelerating towards the Cambodian sales. So right now it's foreign nationals and students.
We can definitely sympathize with that because we had this big event in April. We had about 400 people show up as a startup innovation festival and 25 speakers, mostly about the startup space. Anyway, and we were getting a bit worried, like it was like, I think 2 weeks before, a week before, we'd sold maybe, you know, 50% of our tickets. Right. And we were like, oh, we're not going to, oh, it's, yeah, what are we going to do? And then, yeah, the last week, everything just, you know, I think people don't really plan much more than a few weeks ahead.
Yes,
and they're not used to things being sold out.
Exactly. That's true. But I think, you know, it's coming to a new age of development from this country. I mean, people go where their friends are going to go, right? There's also a social element to everything, even in networking and business. There must be the social element, you know. So if your friends are going and getting invited, you show up, you know, like what's happening that day. So I think it's about also keeping it real. And marketing should be a social element, in regardless of whichever vertical you work in. So I think, yes, it's definitely last minute bookings for everybody. And it's a bit scary, but you got to get used to it. There's no medicine.
Great. Okay. Well, that's really, really interesting to hear. And we hope that a lot of the audience listening to Rising Giants can attend the opera. I think it'll be a very interesting event.
December 10th, by the way. December 10th at Copic Theatre.
Yeah. Copic Theatre. Okay. Yeah, just getting into the last segment of the podcast where we just ask a handful of kind of rapid fire questions about kind of your interpersonal approaches. What are some unusual habits that you have that you love doing that would be that when you tell people that people are surprised?
Yeah, I mean, as an Italian, this probably doesn't come as a surprise to most Italians, but I love coming back home, smashed. No, no joking. Coming back home, but later in the evening, and regardless what time it is, I always make my favorite spaghetti. And it doesn't matter if it's 11 or 3 a.m. It's just I can't stop doing this. And it's very simple. Spaghetti, aglio, olio e peperoncino, which means spaghetti with olive oil and garlic and a little bit of a chili. No one is going to eat that, but I do. And yeah, even my mother goes like, I don't know, we lost you, we lost you. It's too late now. So that's my yeah, it's pretty bad. Mea culpa.
Okay. And what do you think people misunderstand about you the most?
Probably that I'm Italian, because my accent, it really isn't pizza, pasta, it's not like that. And so they expect, you know, everybody, every Italian to talk like that, you know. So when they ask me where I'm from, I say, I'm actually, you know, from Sicily. They go, get out of here, you know, from Sicily. They think I'm making it up to just to be more popular or that. So I give up. I start to say I'm British. And then they say, no, you're not British. You got an accent. Where are you from? So I think it's where I'm from, really. That's the most misunderstood thing. They say South African. Irish, I had Dutch. They never guess Italy. So I had to tell them, show passports and things. I mean, it's pretty embarrassing, but sorry, Italians. I'm not flying the flag very well.
Yeah, just out of curiosity, how often do you manage to get back? You said you're from Sicily. What part of Sicily is that? Okay.
My mother still lives there, so I go there as often as I can. So I think after the opera, it would be a good time to go. So I try once a year. Best time to go is Little Plan for Sicily here. If you plan to go to Sicily, best time to go is June, July, or September, October, because otherwise you will sweat more than you can imagine. It can get pretty hot. So the best time is to avoid August at all costs, but very beautiful country, very beautiful region.
Okay, our last question, just to close out the podcast. This is our traditional closing question for everyone. What is the most important piece of advice that you've ever been given?
Yes. The advice is there is no substitute for hard work. So even if you're very talented at something, and many people are, you have to just put your hours in. You have to produce quality output, and there's no substitute for that. And just in a nutshell, my father was incredibly talented, my mother also. But I've seen how much work they put in. And since an early age, just the long nights, poring over music scores, highlighting things for recordings, for early morning conducting sections, just so much of hard work. And so lesson I learned pretty early on. And so I think everything is possible if you put your mind to it. And even if you lack, you know, for example, we spoke about tennis, okay? Let's say that I want to beat you at tennis, Max, okay? Which is unlikely anytime soon. But if I really put my mind to it and I just go every day and one day, perhaps, if I might get a set out of you. I don't know. It might happen. So that would be my advice that I would also pass on to somebody else. So hard work is, it's the way forward. And again, thanks very much for having me. I really appreciate the opportunity, and it's been great to be part of this podcast and to be in a series of great speakers as well around me. So thanks again.